for plebs by plebs, dropping the Bitcoin only signal. Pleb Underground. Welcome everyone to the Pleb Underground.
Pleb Underground 81st episode. At the end of the year, we'll be on the road. Pleb Underground x Bitcoin plus plus for a Pleb Dev conference, no corporate fuss. You self-custody, a daughter self-owns. Fuck the hate, ignore the groans. See her late, implore the moans. Piano buffet, Nora Jones. With logic, two paradise. Original lines, don't parrot twice. Bitcoin not yet worn, no certain outcome. Canx black on X, a martyr like Malcolm. Printer is coming, not winter, hooger, fronting, let's adorn, no splinter, looper, hunting for the corn, prowl like cougar, eyes on the prize, laser dot, Ruger. If I rush this work, I might be without, he didn't rush his work, so you should be devout, no longer fat boy, slim, praise you like I should, most stronger, sat ploy, betrays you like it could. I rhyme for the realist, for the hold-ons, fuck shitcoins.com, I'm for the hold, ones, italic, underline the bold ones, not for those that fold, one's conscience, one time sold, nuns, don't read from your book, mold tons, with speech, bounce, I told buns, left up in smoke like the rolled ones. From the bard, fitting birds, about my money, listen. To the hard-hitting words, as if I'm Sonny Liston. Train 6 days a week, I'm only back from the gym shortly. I tell the fiat bros, have fun staying portly. Fuck shit coins, tether the hoard shilling. Resist temptation, forever, Lord willing. Buy Bitcoin, be happy, feel more. Use a little logic like Rappy Gilmore. They say Bitcoin is just for a terrorist. Misinformed outsiders, each one's an errorist. I try to speak clearly, this is my oratory. Send it back to Dexter's laboratory. Crime scene instigation after your accident boating. Forensic lean investigation, QR bent noting. Add a signature, maybe one you can read. Use your sign as backup, here is your seed.
Welcome back, everyone. That's right. It is episode 81 of the Pleb Underground, and joining us today, we've got very special guest, fellow Bitcoiner, creator, and leader of Seed Signer. Seed, thank you very much for joining us on the Pleb Underground.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sweet. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, here we go. We are going to move it on over to the numbers.
Yeah, the numbers sourced from Time Chain Stats and Time Chain Calendar and brought to you by BTC Prague. BTC Prague is the biggest Bitcoin-only conference in the world, been going now for 13, 14 years. They have tens of thousands of attendees, hundreds of speakers, and no fucking shit coins. Yes, this is BTC Prague in the Czech Republic. If you use the code PLEB, you can get 10% off all tickets. And if you use the code, if you pay in Bitcoin, you can get a further 5% off tickets. So that's 15% off if paying in Bitcoin with the code PLEB. This is the biggest Bitcoin-only conference in the world, BTC Prague.
At the time of this recording, the block height is 836,827. The Bitcoin fiat exchange, 69,466. Damn, why couldn't we record at 420? Anyways, total public lightning capacity, 4,628 BTC blocks to the halvening. What are we looking at? 3173 fastest fee, 12 sats per V-byte. That's pretty decent. I would consolidate at that level, maybe. Anyways, Moscow time, 1439. Guys, boom. The numbers. Somehow 69K is the new boring 58K. It's maybe the new boring 10K.
I believe 69K is 58K adjusted for inflation, like give or take. So, yeah.
So is that a coincidence? I don't know. Kind of weird.
I'll take 69-ish K. Right? Like that's not a bad consolidation level at all.
So, Seed, you know what? Like, are you bored at these levels? Like, do you find like how do you feel about the vibe right now in the overall space? Like, I feel like nobody cares.
So I'm a natural contrarian. And so when the price starts going up and everybody tweets about it and stuff, like I either need to put the socials down or I start getting grumpy. So for me, consolidation is a happy place.
I like that. All right. We're going to take a look at our first article, Walt. And actually, I think it's our only article for the numbers. This is kind of an interesting one shared by you. Here we go. All right, so this is a retweet from Ben Kaufman, awesome fellow Bitcoiner, used to work on the Spectre project, I believe. Anyways, totally awesome. So here we go. What? And what is he referring to? It is a retweet from Robert Kiyosaki, the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and many other financial self-help books. Anyways, I am buying 10 more Bitcoin before April. Why the halving? If you can't afford a whole Bitcoin, you may want to consider buying 1/10 of a coin via the new ETFs or Satoshis. If the Bitcoin process works as designed, you may own a whole Bitcoin by the end of this year. Hell, I expect Bitcoin to be 100K by September 2024. What has just happened? I think we need to, do we need to talk about what the halving means? Do we need to talk about how that works?
I love the halving without the L. He's going to buy 10 more Bitcoin and he's going to have them. So he will indeed be experiencing a halving.
I like that.
Yeah. So they say that you can't eat your cake and halve it. And I believe that's what this is about. Yeah.
So I just don't understand. I don't understand that whole tweet, because it seems as though he is assuming that you're going to have double the amount of Bitcoin.
Yeah, so what happens is you take a cake, right? And then you halve it and then you enjoy it. It's kind of that simple.
I am to some degree a fan of Robert Kiyosaki. I've read at least two of his books. You have to go into it with your eyes opening, knowing that there never was a rich dad, there never was a poor dad. It's all allegorical, but there is some good financial common sense stuff. Financial literacy is the best term for it. There's some good financial literacy stuff in there that people who, you know, don't have that level of knowledge or that specialized knowledge, there is value there. What he is missing about Bitcoin and that is being put on display in this tweet, I really don't know, and it's frustrating. Weird. If he bought 10 gold bars you know, next month, would he somehow think a year or two from now he would have more than 10 gold bars? I don't understand where this is coming from, but yeah.
I'm not a fan of Robert Kiyosaki, but I can definitely agree with you that there is some very helpful financial literacy, you know, points that he makes. But I do get worried, because guys like him, right? He has a massive account, right? Let's be honest, massive account, massive following. A lot of people pay attention to him. And so, unfortunately, I think this is one of those cases where he really needed to be a little bit more informed than to make that comment. I just want to finish one last thing. But the other thing is that he brought a whole bunch of attention to it. So as much as I don't like the misinformation, I appreciate the eyeballs, I guess. I'll take it.
To me, he's symbolic of the fact that there are millions, if not billions, of people that outsource their financial critical thinking to some face on some sort of media, right? This guy doesn't understand math, and yet people are trusting him with you know, how to math with money. It's not really the best plan.
So yeah. I, being the natural contrarian here, I just want to point out a couple of positive things about this tweet. First, I don't know if it was P.T. Barnum or who said it, but he said something to the effect of, I don't care how you use my name, just don't spell it wrong. And this is, as you said, there are eyeballs. So bringing attention to Bitcoin and normalizing it as a part of a more conventional financial conversation, I don't think is wholly a bad thing. And then I will bring up that he brought up something that a lot of people don't understand or are intimidated by, and that is the prospect of owning a fraction of a Bitcoin. A lot of people see the price at $70,000 and they think that the ship's passed me up, and you know, I can't afford a whole Bitcoin, so what's the point? On a related note, he mentions the ETF shares. I'm not obviously a fan of the ETF shares as a way of as the best way to own Bitcoin. But I am curious over time if some sort of secondary numerical bias emerges as a result of the ETF shares. I don't know what they're trading at. I think it's, is it $40, $50? I don't know what they are. but people will look at the ETF shares as a proxy for Bitcoin, and they will think, huh, $40 or whatever it is. I don't know what it is. Well, I can swing that. And maybe that's their introduction to Bitcoin, and they start learning more about it, and then, of course, realize that your ETF share is just a paper promise for Bitcoin, and it would be better to actually own the asset itself. But that's all I got. Just a few thoughts.
Yeah, no, I definitely appreciate that. And I just in terms of the ETFs, essentially, I saw a tweet yesterday, and I believe it is it takes 1,700. I could be wrong about the exact number, but like approximately 1,766 shares to equal
They come up with that?
Sounds like the number of meters in a mile or something like that. Is it just like, or yards in a mile? It's like,
I saw this whole calculation. I'll see if
it's
I can
almost as
it
if it's Go almost ahead. As if, fractionalizing, assets is something that TradFi already do.
But it is
arbitrarily fractionalizing.
But it is kind of misleading, right? Because let's be honest. I mean, sure, you can make the claim that, 1,700 something shares equals one Bitcoin, but we all know that it's not the same actual
equals asset. A claim to the fiat value of one Bitcoin. Like, yeah,
You're essentially just trying to make a claim to, Bitcoin's value proposition, and you're just essentially holding an IOU. Unfortunately, we know how it works. The legacy markets, this is what they're used to. This is what people feel comfortable with. I can tell you that, somebody that I know pretty well, I've been telling them to buy Bitcoin since last, I think it was like last March or something like that. And the only time they got interested in it was when they were able to buy shares, because that's what they feel comfortable with. And I was like, look, it's not the same thing. I get that you want exposure to it, but it's not the same. Anyways, I get the other side of the coin. It brings eyeballs to Bitcoin, but we know it's not the same. That's the point.
Amen.
So just quick question. When I want to like transfer my Bitcoin ETF units to someone else, which buttons do I press on my seed signer?
I can say that is not a feature that we are currently exploring. So you're going to be trapped in the fiat financial system with that ETF.
When ETF,
it sounds like ETFs are a shitcoin, guys. If you can't use a seed signer on them, if you can't use a signing device on it, it's a shitcoin. Simple as that. So I just want to share one further tweet in numbers. Seed signer referenced being a contrarian. I immediately thought of this meme that Yellow shared earlier this week about the fact that being a contrarian Bitcoiner is so hot right now. And Yellow says that Yellow thinks that most want to be the contrarian Bitcoiner these days, that they end up making huge and hilarious mistakes. I do feel like we're at the phase in the, I don't know if there's a cycle phase, but it's a phase on Bitcoin Twitter where some people want to be the most contrarian Bitcoiner. Who do you gentlemen think is the most contrarian Bitcoiner on Bitcoin Twitter right now? And are they wrong?
Oof, there's so much. First, I just want to point out that Yellow referred to himself in the third person, which was interesting. I don't follow that account, but that stuck out at me. It was interesting. Who is the most contrarian? There's really so much rich.
I feel like Seed
right
might be the most contrarian. Seed doesn't follow Yellow. I thought everyone followed Yellow.
Yeah.
Well, if everyone follows him, I guess I can't. That's the
that's it.
Contrarian.
That is pretty
no,
contrarian.
I don't. Yeah, I didn't realize that this contrarian take was now a thing in Bitcoin. So if you're for protocol ossification, is that a contrarian take right now, or is that the mainstream take?
That depends. That depends on your circle. It's such a gray area, but I would say, I don't know.
I think it's a contrarian take.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's wrong, but.
And I it's admittedly like I am the least technical person on our core team at Seed Signer. I have to be honest and admit that. And so the various takes I have considered about protocol ossification are from people that probably know more about the core protocol than I do. And I read, it's like a Kiyosaki thing. I read them and I have a certain level of trust or appreciation for what I perceive as their level of knowledge or sophistication. And then I pick apart their takes with my observations from real things that have happened. And the kind of number one thing that is front of mind for me right now is the, what would you call it? At best, a spam attack on Bitcoin, and at worst, an actual threat to the Bitcoin protocol that is being posed by all of this silliness around ordinals and inscriptions and that kind of stuff. So I have heard one interview where the person was a proponent of CTV and a proponent of ongoing development of the protocol, which is a position that I can agree with. But they made the claim that the current situation with ordinals and inscriptions could have been entirely anticipated by people who were proposing and supporting the Taproot upgrade, and this was all kind of a known issue going into it. And I feel like if that was a known issue, if we knew that this was going to happen, where the Bitcoin blockchain would start being used basically for graffiti, if that was a known thing, I think the upgrade probably would have gotten less support than what it did get. What we have, in my opinion, is a kind of situation where these unintended consequences of a big upgrade that weren't fully considered or appreciated before the fact happened. So apply those same circumstances to CTV or whatever, you know, someone else's favorite upgrade is. And I have to think about what are the unintended consequences that could come about as a result of X upgrade. And that is what makes me a lot more cautious about further developments in the protocol. Peter Woolis stepped away from Bitcoin development because he perceived that his perceptions of him and his level of knowledge about the protocol were to the point that people trusted him too much. And he just didn't think, with all of the game theory involved, all human beings are capable of mistakes and oversights. And him stepping back, I think, is extremely telling. And I think we should approach this stuff with the utmost caution in terms of upgrades to the protocol. It's generally working well. It's doing what we need it to. And maybe innovation needs to happen on a level or layers above that. My personal take, I'm just overly cautious. I don't know if that's contrarian.
I like the position of being hesitant about upgrades and trying to think about unintended consequences. Yeah. But I think it's also, I understand the position of looking backwards and going, oh, should we have done that upgrade? Maybe that's had some unintended consequences. But you have to recognize where you are in time. The position being that if you want to go backwards on previous soft forks, then that constitutes the hard fork, which isn't very
I wouldn't propose
very
rolling
doable
anything back. Right.
And so as a consequence, therefore, you have to look only from where we are now going forwards. And I think given that there are these non-monetary transactions, the spam, as some people like to call it, if you want there to be less of that proportionally, then you need to have scaling solutions that enable better batching of monetary transactions. And so I think that's actually the argument. Like, if you genuinely are opposed to ordinals, the most effective thing you can do is actually to try and research and promote which scaling solutions you think will enable better batching of transactions, because that's the only incentive-based play to minimize this proportion of bullshit on the blockchain.
I just don't like the urgency-inducing arguments that are put out there by people saying, basically, if we don't do anything to address this problem now, next week it's going to be the top 1% of 1% of people have access to the Bitcoin blockchain directly, and everyone else is going to be in this position of choose your custodian. That's like a classic rhetorical creating urgency to prompt action for a preferred solution. And so This is something we just have to be adults and think carefully about over time. The permissionless assurances that Layer 1 provides, what proportion of the global population in terms of, you know, financial privilege, I don't like that word, but what proportion of the global population really can access Layer 1 Bitcoin before we start to really sacrifice the core components that make the protocol do what it was and provide the assurances that it does. In security, everything is trade-offs. And so I think depending on your use case and your priorities, some of the L2 protocols offer some trade-offs that are reasonable and could be attractive to certain people. I personally want to get as many people into UTXOs and Layer 1 Bitcoin as we can. And that's part of the heart of what we do with SeedSigner. But is everybody going to be able to get into the best lifeboat, which is an L1 UTXO? I don't know if we can fit everybody in the world into the lifeboat. We have to be real and practical, and it's hard to say, and it involves some difficult decisions.
All right, guys, you heard it here first. You're all too fat to get on the lifeboat, so get in shape and maybe we'll fit you in. I don't believe we have any more numbers, so without much further ado,
that wraps up the numbers, and we are going to move it on over to the Fireside Chat. The Fireside Chat is brought to you by BTC Pins. Check out the awesome pins at btcpins.com. Use the code PLEBUNDERGROUND for 5% off amazing pins at btcpins.com. Welcome back, everyone, to the Fireside Chat. You know who we have here. We've got Seed from SeedSigner. Again, thank you so much for joining us. And we are going to dive right into, because we love your product. I have a SeedSigner. I think it was Printer Go Burr who sent me his plans to print up a little case for it. And I love what you're doing. And I love that it feels like a community type of project, and it's been really cool to see you grow it over the years. So why don't we just dive right in? Why did you start?
Phil, one sec. Before you start that, Phil needs to know your orange pilling story. Tell us your journey, sir. How did you get into Bitcoin? What's your background?
I tried, Seed. I tried not to, but we're doing it.
I'll be super brief. My orange pilling story was I've been public about this. Some people know this about me. I was a cop for 15 years. And for 12 of those 15 years, I worked in a digital forensic lab, taking apart computers and phones and trying to see if there was information on them that supported or refuted prosecutions. Most of my work was in crimes against children, but there were other types of crimes that came through our lab. And one day it was late 2012 or early 2013, there was another examiner at the computer lab who was working on a case for this local kid who had a expensive gaming rig with two GPUs, and he was using the GPUs to mine Bitcoin. He would then go to the Silk Road, use the mined Bitcoin to purchase weed, have it shipped to his doorstep, and he was selling dime bags at school. And of course, teachers found out and the principal found out. They called the police, and that's what lands his computers in our forensic lab. And this other guy in the lab was working on this case, and he's like, I have never heard of this Bitcoin thing. I have no idea what it's all about. And he told me about the rest of the details around the case. And that is what was the impetus for my first internet search for Bitcoin. And at that point, I found Bitcoin Talk and I found Reddit. And that's what sent me down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And I've been a Bitcoiner in different ways at different times. But in I think it was 2018 or 2019, I can't remember now, I stepped away from work. I've been super blessed to be a stay-at-home dad. And about, I don't know, 3 to 6 months after I stepped away from work, I started plunking around with Bitcoin cold storage tools, the Spectre DIY most specifically, and started talking to some people that are much smarter than me in Bitcoin terms, and started tinkering with Raspberry Pis, binge watched Udemy videos to learn how to code Python. And that was what...
So SeedSigner's not as old as Spectre DIY. I thought it was older. So thank you for teaching me some history there.
Discovering the Spectre DIY that got me rolling with the idea of a stateless device that is not engineered to store your private keys, and two, this elegant system of air-gapped QR code exchange that creates this tiny little communication protocol between the device that talks to the Bitcoin network, which is your laptop, your phone, and then the device that talks to your private keys, which is your signer or your hardware wallet. And that QR animated QR exchange process was just so elegant to me as a solution to minimize the risk of communicating signatures back and forth. So that is what sent me down. That was the impetus for the Seed Center project. I started interacting with Moritz and Stepan and some of the Spectre guys, and started talking to Michael Flaxman, who's another Bitcoin security researcher. And that was the birthplace of Seed Center project.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay. So I think it's very interesting that you mentioned Spectre DIY, because I also myself, I purchased one of those devices. I bought the hardware individually to build my own, and then I loaded their firmware and everything. But then I wanted the fancy one with their little case and everything and the cards.
The smart card capability.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Like that was super cool. And so they used a very specific, I feel like it's an STM board or an ESP32 board. I forget which
Disco
one.
Disco is the only thing I remember is
Disco?
Part of the marketing. Yeah. Some sort of STM Disco board or something.
So I'm guessing that seeing that got you thinking, all right, like, you know, what type of board can I use? So I guess my question to you is, did you kind of line up like a bunch of different boards to try to figure out which one to use with your product? Like how did that work?
No, that was totally accidental and organic.
Okay.
Two things. So I mentioned my Bitcoin story is kind of a story in two acts. And in first, like 2013 through 2017, Bitcoin was an investment to me. You know, I'm a young guy with a family and a mortgage, and I'm just trying to, you know, figure out how to pay things down and make all the numbers work to make life better for my family. And during that period of time, you know, I had Bitcoin in cold storage. In early 2017, I panic sold all of it. And I thought that part of the reason that I panic sold, there were multiple factors, but I thought that part of the reason was because I was not super confident about my Bitcoin cold storage setup. And that's what got me thinking about act two of my Bitcoin life. Given my unique background in digital forensics, what are the ingredients that would make me more confident with my Bitcoin storage? And the two things I was probably the most uncomfortable with most conventional hardware wallets at the time were one, USB connectivity, and then two, this idea of trusting a secure element to store my private keys over time, which isn't entirely a bad value proposition. There are just trade-offs with it that I think a lot of people don't fully realize what they're getting into. But first, USB, when you connect two devices via USB, there are things that you don't necessarily understand or anticipate happen that could happen. If you can update the firmware over that USB protocol, when you plug something in via USB, anything can happen if, you know, the wrong malware or you're tricked into doing the wrong thing with your system. So I was never comfortable with that USB connection. And then with my background in digital forensics, I had access to tools that are developed by private corporations with funding from U.S. federal government entities. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say every secure element's backdoored or anything like that, but I was provided a lot of Apple phones, Samsung phones, and some phones that are considered to be generally secure as a part of my time working. And using tools that I had access to, I couldn't get into all of them, but I got into a lot of devices that were that had PIN codes or Face ID or whatever, using little tricks and exploits that these private companies develop. So the idea of a secure element as the end-all, be-all source of what I could trust for long-term Bitcoin security, it's just not something that I personally bought. So given those two things, that is how that was kind of the context in which the Seed Signer developed. But in terms of the hardware choice, it was literally Michael Flaxman telling me in a DM that he had an idea to build a device that was a Raspberry Pi Zero. So it's a specific version of the Raspberry Pi Zero that didn't have wireless connectivity, no Wi-Fi, no Bluetooth, no NFC or anything like that. And you would attach a screen and some controls to it that would give you the ability to enter seed words into it. And then you would use that device to calculate the checksum word, which some people may not realize. The last word of a seed phrase is deterministic, meaning it is determined by the words that precede it. And it's kind of an error checksum that accompanies the seed phrase. If you were to type one of the words wrong into another tool, the tool should alert you and be like, something doesn't add up here. Go back and check. Maybe you entered something wrong. So his idea was to use a Raspberry Pi Zero as this very isolated little computing environment that you could use to securely create seed phrases for private keys for a multiple, you know, variety of purposes. I thought that was a compelling idea. So I took it, and that's when I mentioned I started learning, you know, just enough Python to be dangerous to create a working concept for this tool. And after I got a working concept of that tool done, I thought, what if I had a $5 camera to this? I could basically replicate the whole feature set of the Spectre DIY. We could use the camera to read in QR codes. And then the prototype I had has a tiny little screen, and you could use that to display QR codes. And you could use both those aspects of it to communicate with whatever device, you know, your Spectre desktop or whatever other device you're using your wallet software on. And in talking with Stepan Snigarev, who was the chief architect kind of behind the Spectre DIY, he kind of laughed and thought, I don't know what your criteria were, but using Raspberry Pi for your particular use case was kind of a stroke of genius, given the cost of the hardware and the computing power that's built into it. And we've sort of leveraged different aspects of the Raspberry Pi over time. One point being, it's a very traditional computer architecture. And what people who are deeper into computer science realize, while a lot of people don't, is with this traditional computer architecture, you typically have a general purpose CPU, you have a hard drive that is used to persistently store data, and then you have RAM that is used to temporarily work with data while the computer is on and being used. An interesting feature of RAM is that it's characterized as volatile memory. And the nature of that is such that while the memory has power, you can load data into it, you can work with that data. But when you remove power from RAM, it kind of resets back to a default memory state. So any information that was in there is permanently lost. And that's really the heart of what we leverage with SeedSigner, is this traditional computer architecture that includes RAM. And our software, at the time of boot, when you start the SeedSigner up, all of our software is loaded into RAM on the Raspberry Pi board, to the point that you can actually remove the memory card after you see our UI come up, and then our entire software stack runs in RAM. That's what creates the assurances around statelessness behind SeedSigner. So that capability, in addition to the lack of wireless communication capability, are kind of the two things that are the secret sauce to SeedSigner. Add into that the DIY aspect of it. And the DIY aspect is just the idea of using commodity hardware that is not being manufactured or distributed specifically for a Bitcoin purpose. So our users can go to a variety of websites in different countries, different parts of the world, and they can purchase the components that they need to build a SeedSigner without the person selling them those components knowing that they're specifically going to be used for a Bitcoin use case. And that takes what is often referred to as supply chain risk out of the equation, because the person selling you it has really no incentive to try to exploit the hardware knowing that you're going to use it for a Bitcoin purpose. I will say that myself and other people do build and sell seed signers to other people for those who are either not comfortable, don't have the time, or don't have the core knowledge that it's really easy to build one, but a lot of people just don't realize that it seems too technical. So they want to buy one from a third party. That's a little different situation. You do give up some of that supply chain risk mitigation if you're going to buy it from someone who's selling it to you as a Bitcoin tool. Is this a deal breaker? I don't think so. In security, trade-offs are everything. So for those people who are willing to take on, you know, that aspect of the trade-offs, for some people, they want to build their own seed signer. And we put the code out there. We put the instructions out there. We even put the designs for the 3D printable enclosures out there. Everything's out there. You don't want to go through somebody else. You want to do it on your own. That's absolutely an option that is not as difficult or as intimidating as most people think. But that's, I think your original question was about the impetus behind the original hardware selection. And it was to some degree accidental, with people who are smarter than me suggesting things that we just kind of grew into.
I really appreciate you giving us that deep dive. Walton, I have a tweet that I want to pull up, but did you have any, did you have a question for Seed first before we pulled that up?
Yeah, so I have the hard question is what, some have said that the Seed Sign uses, I believe, a Broadcom chip, and that chip is not open source. Should we be trusting Broadcom? Are we trusting Broadcom?
To a certain extent, we do trust Broadcom, but we put mitigations in there that I believe allow people to check the receipts, because the Seed Signer, as I've mentioned, does not have wireless communication capability, and that dramatically limits the amount of badness that you can do. So if Broadcom really is backdoored, and you know, an evil person at the Broadcom factory or an evil maid in your home that has taken your signing device and is going to export some sort of unknown aspect of the Broadcom chip, which is, I should mention, that's the CPU that's, you know, the default, that's what all Raspberry, as far as I know, that's what all Raspberry Pi, not just Zeros, but the other builds too, use a Broadcom chip. If there is some sort of evil in there, because the device is not communicating wirelessly and is limited to this cumbersome sort of QR exchange process, that dramatically limits what badness it can do. The signature scheme that we use produces Bitcoin signatures that are identical to Bitcoin cores. So if you want to create a transaction and examine the signatures and make sure that it's not doing something that is an undesirable, leaking a bad signature is probably the limit of what could it do. Could this Broadcom backdoor or malware or whatever, could it save your seed to the board in some way? That it's possible, but all of this stuff is so edge case and tinfoil hat. I don't do the best job at refuting all the FUD, because frankly, it's an exhausting job. And I don't know. The other day there's a core dev called Peter Todd, who is a extremely good adversarial thinker, and his technical knowledge far exceeds that which mine does. And people are familiar with Rodolfo Novak, who's the principal at CoinKite, as he is unfortunately often want to do, tweets these kind of vague assertions about Broadcom and backdoors and all these kind of attacks. And much to his credit, Peter Todd, who I've met a few times and talked to, picked apart the argument that Rodolfo is trying to make, to a degree that, I talk about Seed Signer a lot, but explaining these nuances is something that he's even better at than me. And I say, show me the exploit. Show me a working exploit. Let's not talk about theoretical attacks. Like the Ledger Dungeon guys talked about a theoretical attack on the cold card involving both of the SEs in some sort of, you know, I don't know if it was a side channel attack or what the particular, but it's a hypothetical attack. You can make a lot of hypothetical attacks up, including hypothetical attacks on Seed Signer. Show me an exploit that involves stock hardware and our software, not some sort of modified version of our software, but our software. If you can show me an attack that involves those things, I will pay attention and start seriously thinking about it. But all of this hypothetical stuff involving Broadcom, to get back to your original question, being backdoored or closed source, or there's some sort of potential malfeasance going on with it, there are hypothetical attacks on the hardware wallets, supply chains that we could talk about too. Sometimes we get too far into the weeds with this tinfoil stuff.
So one thing I like to do to reduce liability with a particular signing device is to use multisig. Can you talk a little bit, just briefly, about how can you use Seed Signer in a multisig in the best way? Which wallet software can be used with seed signer and multisig. And then I believe Phil has some further questions for you.
Yeah. So Spectre Desktop, Sparrow Wallet, Blue Wallet Vaults, Nunchuck, and there's a newer multisig coordinator called Keeper. Seed signer is compatible with all of those. And you can use a seed signer in combination with any other mix of hardware and software stacks to diversify any potential risks that could be out there in the threat environment that is Bitcoin. The security researcher I referenced before, Michael Flaxman, has written an excellent document called the 10x Bitcoin Security Guide. It's hosted on GitHub. If you do just an internet search for 10x Bitcoin Security Guide, he does a great job of talking about the threat environment and zeroing in on what ways that you can improve your Bitcoin security posture to get the most bang for your buck. And multisig is absolutely, I think, a key part of that process. Multisig is what impressed me so much about how the Bitcoin cold storage ecosystem has evolved over time. As someone who, as I said previously, was in law enforcement, I've assisted executing search warrants. I've gone into people's houses looking for evidence. Bitcoin multisig is such an asymmetrically powerful tool that puts the power in the hands of the defenders that is frankly a nightmare for just civilian adversaries who might want to try to steal your Bitcoin or state type of adversaries who might be trying to seize your Bitcoin as a part of some sort of legal action. Now, it's not just a matter of going to someone's house and stealing one key. It's maybe you can go to their house and get one key, but you have to figure out what is the threshold of other keys I need in addition to the wallet descriptor, if we want to get more technical, or the public keys you need to be able to recreate the wallet and then have access to the private keys to be able to control the funds. Are those stored in a bank deposit box down the road? Are those at grandma's house in the attic? Are they in, you know, your best friend's gun safe? Are they buried under a tree in Andalusia? You know, these keys could be anywhere in the world. And that, as I said, creates this asymmetric kind of nightmare attack for anyone wanting to steal or seize your Bitcoin. So Seed Signer is extremely multisig friendly. The project was created primarily with multisig in mind. The initial versions of our software didn't even include the option to set up single sig wallets. So Seed Signer,
because I'm a multisig maxi, I went straight from exchange to using multisig. Like I don't like the lack of redundancy with single sig. I think it's dangerous. I'm always a fan of people pushing the envelope forward in multisig. So thank you very much for the work.
And if
that you're
I can
doing.
Say one more thing, maybe some people's gateway drug to multisig is a Seed Signer. Because the device is stateless, if you're not sure if multisig is for you, if you're going to be able to be comfortable with it, understand what additional pieces of information or how you need to be organized to do it, with just one Seed Signer, you can create three keys and you can manage each of those keys with just the single Seed Signer, because when you unplug the device, the information that stores on it goes away. And so it's reasonable to manage a multisig with a single device like a Seed Signer. Maybe because when I initially wanted to get into multisig, you know, you have to buy 3 cold cards, 5 Trezors, you're looking at $400 or $500 or more just to be able to set one up and move a little money to it and see if you're comfortable with it and if it's going to work for you for cold storage. With that one Seed Signer, maybe you set up a Sparrow wallet, create some keys, go on testnet, or just use a tiny bit of money on mainnet and deposit some funds after you set up the wallet, make a couple transactions, see if it's something that you're comfortable with. And then maybe after that, then you spend the $300-$500 on the other hardware wallets you need to be able to set up the ideal setup that involves different hardware and software stacks and different trade-offs and different risk profiles. But I love to think of, because I'm a multisig maxi too, and I hate to see multisig get FUDded in terms of, oh, you have to, you know, there are easy ways to manage the additional information keeping requirements, you know, that exist within multisig, very doable, even for people with less technical ability. But I love to think of Seed Signer as this kind of gateway drug into multisig, where it allows you with just one device and a little bit of time and effort to get into multisig, get your toe in the door and just start to experience it and see if it feels like something that you could benefit from.
So it's appropriate then that seed signers are shaped like orange pills because they actually help with that step to self-custody. Because I don't really think someone's orange pilled until they have Bitcoin in self-custody, right? If you've still got it on the exchange, are you really orange pilled? I don't know.
That's a good point.
Phil, I believe you have some more questions for Seed.
We're going to quickly dive into some drama before we appropriately move over to Rekt. So here we go.
Before the embers of the fire start to slowly fade.
That's right. Okay, so this was a tweet from you that you retweeted a screenshot here. So super disappointing to see this FUD towards our project, you know, being blindly retweeted by Stefan Lovera. I wonder who sponsors this podcast and has done so for a long time. And yeah, so here, let's take a look at the tweet itself that was retweeted. So it's @BTC. So you think your Raspberry Pi hardware wallet you assembled in your basement doesn't have a radio? Anyways. Get cold card wallet. Stop playing with your toys. How I broadcast LoRa packets without a radio. So I'm assuming that this person is hinting that even though there is no connectivity, let's say built into the Raspberry Pi Zero, somehow has added the ability for a Wi-Fi radio, which I don't know, maybe I'm assuming wrong, but to me, like, I don't really consider that, like, how many people out there genuinely know how to do that kind of stuff? Anyways, I don't know if you could just shed some light on that tweet.
So this tweet actually came out just this morning. This is the kind of stuff I get to wake up to. And
it's wrong.
I haven't fully dug into it yet, but as I understand it, at the very least, it involves running maliciously modified software on your seed signer software, which at this point doesn't exist. That's one of the more troubling things about that tweet is he uses the word I in that tweet as though he has already developed this exploit and proved it out as being possible. That's a little bit of nuance that maybe not all people pick up on. Yeah. So you have to run some sort of malicious version of our software, which as anybody, you know, who's in information security or computer science or even, you know, an average user knows that if you run malicious software, unintended bad things can happen. This exploit is going to require a modified version of our code that somehow creates this, again, I just learned about this morning, this ultra low frequency radio wave that you're going to be able to receive from somewhere else. So someone has to trick you into running bad software on your seed signer, which, you know, that, I'm not saying that's not possible at all, but we emphasize to our users very heavily, you need to either build our software from source libraries, or at the very least, download the copy of the software that we put out there and make sure that you download the accompanying hash to verify that you're getting a known good version of our software and don't load anything onto your seed signer without doing that process. Best case, build the code yourself and then compare it to the hash. But if you're not going to do that, make sure you hash the software to make sure. Now, again, this is this type of esoteric stuff where the tweet was in a couple ways a half measure too clever. And the I part was one aspect of the half measure too clever. And then the other part was like, oh, I'm going to throw in an endorsement for cold card into this. It's not a legitimate, like, expressing an honest concern, which is, you know, an essential part of concern trolling is that, like, I hate to say this, but on these things that are so popular and being used by so many people, there's this possibility for a vulnerability. Throwing in the cold card reference is, you know, another kind of half measure too clever, which I don't know if that's why Lovera retweeted it. I have to give Stefan credit. When SeedSigner was very young as a project, he had me on his podcast, probably within the first 6 months of SeedSigner existing.
I listened to you there. That's how I first heard of you.
That helped a lot of people discover and learn more about this tool and this larger security model that we were proposing and building and thinking through at the time. And that got a lot of, you know, exposure for our project and, you know, whatever out there. Sorry. And Stefan Lovera is, you know, he has a lot of good interviews and a lot of good Bitcoiners on his show that talk about things that are important to Bitcoin security, Bitcoin adoption, the Bitcoin network. It's just these incentives that are created by podcasts and conferences that are, that create an uphill battle for our project. And we're purely a free and open source software project that is created by volunteers, people who don't stand to make much money off of building and spreading this design around. And there's kind of two aspects of, you know, the hardware wallet, the commercial hardware wallet space, challenging us as a project. There's one, what we just saw, these kind of targeted attacks that are from a known source. NVK puts this kind of stuff out there all the time about Broadcom being backdoored or, mm-hmm. you know, these kind of esoteric weird attacks. That's a very targeted sort of attack. It is mm-hmm. what it is on our project. And then the other sort of aspect of it is what I would say is just the natural set of incentives or malincentives that arise from there being a hardware wallet industry to begin with. Hardware wallet makers have a commercial product that they want to sell as many of as they can. And because they have money coming in as a result of selling products that, you know, have their use cases. I don't want to tell you that all hardware wallets are bad or that they don't have cold storage use cases or you can't use them in a multi-sig with other tools to, I don't want to say that at all. It's just they make money from selling hardware wallets. They buy podcast ads. They pay for booths at conferences. They have promotional promo codes with influencers and all this kind of stuff. Because they have access to these platforms, they get to shape the information landscape and emphasize certain threats that, lo and behold, their product is the solution to those threats that they would emphasize. Most people, the biggest threat to their Bitcoin is, number one, them doing something stupid. And creating a wallet where they don't understand what they need to preserve or don't understand that, you know, their seed words are the keys of the kingdom. And it's not even a matter of someone else stealing their money or stealing their seed phrase. It's just them doing something stupid and not understanding what they need to preserve to keep their Bitcoin. Number two,
that's why everyone should use multi-sig.
Right. Which, you know, it's with great power comes great responsibility. So you do need to dig in and learn a little bit more.
But it's kind of crazy how people say, oh, noobs shouldn't use multi-sig because they'll make a mistake. I'm like, yeah, but multi-sig is what you need in case you do make a mistake.
Understand that at first. I didn't understand that at first. I only understood that after the fact. I'm sorry, continue.
Right. Not at all. So the first is the biggest threat is, one, people doing dumb stuff that they're going to screw themselves over doing. Mm-hmm. Number two is losing keys. Like that's part of part one. But this idea that you have an evil maid who's cleaning your house and is just waiting to get her hands on your hardware wallet or find your seed words. Is it going to happen? Maybe. People's ex-girlfriends do sometimes steal seed phrases and stuff. But that is not the greatest threat to most people's Bitcoin. Another thing I will point out in the context of multisig, because you mentioned multisig and what a powerful tool you think it is, with a conventional hardware wallet. Mm-hmm. That hardware wallet is a digital device that is storing a digital copy of your private key. When you first set up that hardware wallet, what's the first thing that all the manufacturers have you do? They usually give you a little card that came with your device, and they tell you before you deposit any funds to it, before you set up, you know, whatever coordinator you're going to use, you're presented with seed words, and they tell you to write these words down and put them somewhere safe. Now, this creates a situation where you have two copies of the keys of the kingdom, two copies of your private key that you need to worry about adequately safeguarding, not losing, and protecting. With multi-sig, even a simple two of three, if you're using three conventional hardware wallets, each of those hardware wallets is something that you have to protect because each of them contain a copy of your private key, and each of those hardware wallets has told you to write down 12 or 24 words that you need to put in a safe place. So you actually need, if you're doing things right, six places to hide things, because you don't want to hide the seed words right next to the hardware wallet, because chances are you didn't use a passphrase on the seed words because you had the perception that this hardware wallet has a pin phrase or a fingerprint, you know, whatever, some sort of access control prevention that prevents people from accessing it. So it doesn't make sense to put those seed words right next to the hardware wallet. So you really need to be hiding six different things in six different places. In the context of multisig, which for me, my multisig wallet is the one that I very very rarely interact with the private keys. I may frequently make deposits to it. I may frequently open up the wallet and look at the balance. You don't have to have access to the private keys to check the balance or make deposits. It's only when you want to spend from that hardware wallet that you need to get access to the private keys. And I might do that once or twice a year to consolidate UTXOs, or maybe for a big purchase that I want to make, or maybe just for peace of mind to do a self-transfer just to confirm that I still have access to the keys I need. If you're only doing that once or twice a year, why have this second digital device storing your private keys that you have to worry about suddenly failing and having to fall back? Why not just let the analog private copy of your private keys, whether it's on paper or in metal, why not just let that analog copy be the only copy of the private keys that you have to worry about securing and maintaining? That's the value of this whole idea behind stateless signing, which is catching on with some of the hardware wallet manufacturers. With a stateless signer, you're just using that device as a signer. You're not using it as a private key persistent storage tool.
Yeah.
For devices, for Bitcoin wallets like a checking account that you treat more of like that, where you're spending a couple times a month, it makes sense to have that trade-off where you have the private key more accessible. It's being protected by a device. There are some access control restrictions, but you can still keep it in your house someplace safe. That totally makes sense. But in this long-term cold storage use case where you're rarely interacting with private keys, you have to keep backups anyway. Why not just let the backups be the copy of the keys that you worry about maintaining? Jade has introduced, I don't know if they call it QR mode or whatever, but they've adopted a workflow that's very similar to using a seed signer where you power on the device, you scan a QR code, or you type seed words into it. You can sign transactions or set up wallets or whatever while the keys are on the device and it's up and active. But when you power it off, the keys go away, similar to a seed signer. I actually found out on Twitter yesterday or the day before that the cold card account responded in one of a tweet thread that I had put something in that they're calling them temporary keys now. But I believe the cold card queue has a way to temporarily import a seed phrase, I assume either by scanning a QR code that's an encoded seed phrase or by typing the words in, to where that is a temporary seed on the device. So you could hypothetically use a cold card queue the same way you use a seed signer to manage an entire multi-sig quorum. And when you need to make a spend from that multi-sig, maybe you have to go to a safe deposit box, maybe you have to go to your friend's house or wherever you're deciding to hide your private keys, but you could just use that one device to manage an entire quorum. It's a concept I think that makes a lot of sense. You have this centralizing kind of factor in terms of you have to trust that that device is honest and not compromised. But for some people, being in a multi-sig wallet that is a two of three that's managed with one device is still better than having a single sig wallet on a single sig hardware wallet or a single sig wallet that's comprised of one key. It's not the perfect setup that combines all of these different hardware and software stacks, but it's still better than a single sig wallet because you have that redundancy that you've also alluded to. I talked a lot there, so I'm going to shut up.
No, we appreciate it. I mean, that's the whole point, right? I think you gave a well-rounded explanation. I think it's interesting that the cold card is essentially implementing your feature set to a certain extent, right? Because like that's really what that is. And to me, if you ask me, that's kind of a compliment, right? Like that is, you know, it's kind of a.
Sometimes it feels like a backhanded compliment.
Yeah, it is. No, it is a backhanded compliment, no doubt. But it's still acknowledging that you were right, but not acknowledging you were right. Anyways, look, that was absolutely awesome. I really appreciate it. I love your product. I'm going to put in the show notes. You mentioned where is it? The 10x Bitcoin security guide. We are going to add that to the show notes.
Great.
Thing. We're going to put a link to your website also as well in the show notes for the viewers and listeners. And just one last time before, because we're going to wrap up this segment, we're going to move it on over to Rekt. How can the viewers and listeners find you or ask you questions?
Yeah, just I am on both Twitter and Nostr. The handle's just Seed Signer. We have a wonderful Telegram community that has like 2,300 Bitcoiners in it, where there's all sorts of great discussion.
Wow.
around different multi-sig, you know, ideas, different security models. You know, we try to keep it honest and open discussion where people can ask questions about building a seed signer, using a seed signer, or incorporating it into a multi-sig setup. So you can find the link to that Telegram group at seedsigner.com. I tweet about it periodically, so look for that as well. But yeah, as I said, just Seed Signer on Twitter or on Noster, and you can follow the crazy things I sometimes, you know, post.
Awesome. We're going to add that to the show notes. Thank you so much. And guys, that wraps up the Fireside Chat. We are going to move it on over to Wrecked. Wrecked is brought to you by CipherSafe. Check them out at ciphersafe.io. Do you know about the Bitcoin Rollo Triangle? Probably not, but you should check it out at ciphersafe.io. We're talking 16 ounces of solid titanium, beautiful craftsmanship, made by a fellow Bitcoiner. Check it out at ciphersafe.io. Welcome back, everyone. Look, this week in Wrecked, that, not going to lie, there was a lot. And I'm starting off with an apology, right? I'm going to apologize to all of you for what's about to happen. But yeah, if you haven't figured out that we are entering a bull market and that the grifters are about to start fleecing the noobs in overdrive, yeah, you got a lot coming because it's happening, and it's happening quick. And here we go. This is just a total terrible, terrible post. The girls of Cardano. And just so you know, even if it was the guys of Cardano, all of this is cringe. All of this is cringe. Okay, so I apologize. Here we go. We're just going to watch a little bit of it, not too much. We just don't want to freak everyone out, okay?
We're Cardano girls. Of course we're real.
We're Cardano girls. Of course we treat ourselves with the money we save on gas. It's girl math.
We're Cardano girls. Of course we have Charles as our phone wallpaper.
We're Cardano girls. Of course we get random NFTs sent to our wallet as gifts all the time. Thanks, boys.
We're Cardano girls. We buy ADA while the men create all the drama.
They keep putting my fucking bags, bro. I don't know why they keep putting.
We're Cardano girls. And no, we don't want to see your snack.
Okay, there's only so much I can take of that. There really is only so much I can take of that. So guys, look, this is horrible bull market crap. There goes my camera, but it's all good. I'm so sorry, but I did just have to share that with you just so that you can see what the hell is going on. I don't know if either of you want to comment on this before we move on, but I just, yeah, it's cringe. I don't know what else to say.
The having Charles Hoskinson as the wallpaper on your phone was the was the part that got me. Yeah, total cringe.
Oh yeah. Okay. It is just absolutely brutal. Okay, moving on. And that was, I think, Walton. I think you shared that with us. I don't know.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, it's yeah.
I mean, that was a good
it's
one.
It's clearly that stage in the bull market where the shit kind of start paying people to talk about stuff.
Yeah, she just explained how people send her NFTs. Like, it's just like, yeah, and now you're hurting the simps. Good job. Okay, anyways, on to some real Wrecked, like something way more, you know, important. This is a retweet from Mandrick. And as you guys know, SBF was sentenced this week, 25 years, right? He ripped off a bunch of poor people. Let's be honest, poor people and middle class people. That's really who lost out. Okay, it wasn't the elites that lost out. Anyways, let's dive into it here. So Ross Ulbricht, double life sentence for making a website, right? That's what he did. He just enabled commerce. But the thing is that he threatened the wealthiest institutions. You may not believe that, but believe me, a free market is a threat. Make no doubt. Only the illusion of a free market is allowed to stand, but not free markets. Anyways. And SBF only got 25 years for stealing billions. And before we move on to the last piece of Wrecked, I just want to get your guys' comments on this, because I find it sad and sickening that we live in a, and I understand the government's point of view of seeing somebody like Ross as like some type of an enemy to the state and whatnot, but I feel as though the blatant hypocrisy right? That somebody like SBF gets 25 years for really destroying people's lives. Ross destroyed nobody's life. His life was destroyed. Okay, like that is the complete opposite. And this guy's gonna rot in jail, but yet this prick who has a bunch of, you know, hookups and who didn't rip off the intelligentsia, because let's face it, I don't think he's gonna, and I understand, I'm not saying that 25 years is like a cakewalk or something like that. Like, I'm not trying to be a hypocrite. 25 years is still 25 years, but the reality is he's not going to serve it. And in my eyes, the reality is Ross, those sentences should be swapped. That's my point. Anyways, Seed, what are your thoughts on this?
It's a complicated thing. Ross definitely shouldn't be in jail anymore. So I, you know, have mentioned my background in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Ross Ulbricht knowingly took on the most powerful empire in the history of the world with what he did with the Silk Road. He had to have done that knowing that there would be consequences if he was eventually caught with what he was doing. Right or wrong, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, that is what he did.
Yeah.
But putting someone behind bars for the rest of their life for what he did, that's not justice. That's not fair. And then the whole system, it is so difficult to operate, once again, as a contrarian, in this world, because all of the things that, you know, you're suspicious about being true, so many of them are ending up to be true. And the rampant corruption in our political system, which was, oh my gosh, put on display by SBF and all of the legislators in Congress fawning over him. Didn't Maxine Waters blow him a kiss or something like that? Like, it, because he was giving them money. And it's the corruption that is on display, and that, you know, when you put those sentences side by side, that it highlights is, you know, people around the world probably listen to this. I'm crying about it as an American who's ashamed of what his country and political system has evolved into. But I tweeted about it, admittedly, for the first time the other day, that Ross should be out, because it's something that I've wrestled with a little bit. But I think he's done his time. He's square with the house. I think he could do really good things in the world, and hopefully he gets pardoned. That's
I hope so, but I'm afraid that's not going to happen. And I really hope to God that somebody eventually gets into office that makes that greases the wheels and makes that happen, because I do understand the whole point that they want to make, whoever it is wants to make a example of him, right? You don't want to go against the system. Your fucking life is going to be ruined if you do, you know? So anyways, Walton, what are your thoughts on this before we move on?
If you're against drugs because you think they drive violent crime, creating a way that disintermediates the potential for there to be more violent crime with regards to the actual drug deal, that's surely a good thing.
A reduction of friction.
There's... I think, yeah, irrespective of your opinion on drugs, like, if you really think this through, like, the guy reduced the potential for violence, and I think that should be praised, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a good take. Okay, we're gonna move on here, guys. The big news of the week. I hate to say that, because it's not even really the big news, because Bitcoiners knew this all along, right? But for some reason, BSVers, they just don't get it. Here we go. That's right. We're gonna dive into some Craig Wright, I guess, misery. That's right, guys. More news out. Craig Wright assets frozen by the UK judge to prevent him evading court costs. Now, it's interesting. Some of us read this news and go, oh, yeah, I mean, I guess I guess that's what happened, right? They're gonna freeze his assets, you know, because they see him as a risk. So Judge James Mellor ordered a worldwide freeze on 6 million British pounds of Craig Wright's assets. In a court case brought by COPPA, Mellor found earlier this month that Wright was not Satoshi Nakamoto, okay, the inventor of Bitcoin, which Bitcoiners have known all along. The judge ruled that there was a risk Wright would move his assets offshore to avoid paying costs related to the case. Now, this seems pretty obvious, right? They're going to freeze his bank accounts. You know, they're going to freeze everything that the system can. And for those of us that have been following along, I am one of the people who believes that he is completely full of shit and has no Bitcoin. That's just my take. I don't think he has any. I think the whole story is fake. I just don't think he has anything left. Anyways, that doesn't stop the mental gymnastics. Okay, that doesn't stop the mental gymnastics. And we are going to take a look at some of these mental gymnastics. So here we go. This is an account, Ken Shadido. Anyways, if this order involves Craig's BTC holdings, core devs, this is great, guys. You're going to appreciate this. Core devs can write a patch and send it to the miners to suspend the coins. It's going to be a good demonstration of how coins can be suspended following the law. These people are so, like, delusional that they don't understand him not being like what that means. They don't understand what that means in the grand scheme of things. Like, you have been taken in by a fraud, okay? There is no patch that the developers are going to write to give him back his illusionary Bitcoin. None of this shit exists, okay? Here's one more comment here. This is actually one of my favorite accounts to just mock, because it's just ridiculous crap. Anyways, so this is, again, dealing with the assets that are frozen. So here we go, guys. BTC mining needs to shut down now. BTC Core, because that's what they refer to us to, will need to freeze the entire Bitcoin blockchain. So here comes some insane mental gymnastics, and I apologize for the brain deadness that's about to happen, okay? You don't know which BTC addresses Craig owns. So for years, they've been pointing to addresses that Craig owns, okay? For years, I've been watching BSV accounts sit there and show posts of, that's one of Craig's addresses. This is one of Craig's addresses. All of a sudden, this verdict, right? This thing about the freezing assets come out, and boom, now we have to freeze the whole blockchain. So there's these addresses that were originally pointed to that he never owned any of that Bitcoin, and now we need to freeze the whole Bitcoin blockchain because we have no idea what his addresses are. These people genuinely scare the shit out of me. And the reason why they scare me is because the delusion and the brainwashing that has occurred, I actually didn't think, and I guess I'm just naive, I didn't think could happen. Anyways, what are you guys' thoughts on the Craig Wright stuff?
It reminds me of there's a guy called Ryan X Charles who's on Twitter who, back in 2016, I think he was he's a coder and a venture funded guy, and he was going to start this social network called Yours that was supposed to embody a lot of the V for V spirit that I think Nostra has captured. Like, he was going to have tipping on there, as well as, you know, using V4V payments to unlock content and that kind of stuff. And I thought that idea was really compelling at the time. And then the whole fork wars of 2016, 2017 happened, and he went off the Bitcoin SV deep end. And he was tweeting over the last few weeks as this Craig Wright information had come out. And one of his tweets was, you know, I guess I was wrong about everything. What do you guys think about me trying to reintegrate into Bitcoin and documenting my journey? And, you know, basically, like, I've realized I was wrong and I want to maybe, you know, get back into Bitcoin. And then 2 or 3 days later, there was a tweet of, I have decided to create an alternate blockchain that is in accordance with Satoshi's writings and vision, and I'll be beginning work immediately. I'm just paraphrasing, but it was just like 3 days he went from like, maybe I was wrong and I'm going to try to take the right path to, nope, starting another scam. That's so emblematic of how these people think and approach the world. It's just an opportunity to lie, deceive, and steal from others.
It's a good point. And actually, to your point, before we go to Walton's comment and we wrap up, Rekt, I speaking with fellow Bitcoiner Sawala, who's out of Australia, and he pointed out that possibly that account is fake. Okay. And then I was like, well, wait a second, though. He filmed a video. Like, he filmed a video saying that Craig is a fraud, you know, like that. Oh, really? That was part on that account. Yeah. So I showed him that, and he, Sawala, was under the impression that it's an AI. Now, look, I personally don't know, but I can say this. After he mentioned this, I paid more attention to that account, and the insane crap that came out of it, I was like, you know what? Maybe this is a troll account. Like, this very well could be a troll account. I'm not 100% sure, because supposedly he left Twitter a few years ago. Anyways, I'm just saying the mental gymnastics that I see out of the BSV supporters, none of this would surprise me. None of it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Or maybe he had an opportunity to cash in and sold his Twitter account, you know, at some point. Who knows?
Yeah. That too. No, that's a good point too, you know. Walton, what are your thoughts on this before we wrap up? Well, wrap up that segment.
I don't know why, but the name Ryan Charles sounds like some sort of rainbow sort of boy band kind of name. Not that you can, you know, make all the judgments based off this sort of thing. I'm always very questioning of people that have first names as their last names. So, surname like Charles, don't like it. But yeah, the first thing, I only saw this guy for the first time ever this week, so it's disgusting that he's been around since 2016. It's very embarrassing.
Sure is.
Or older, you said. This guy's like, oh, okay, so I'm a BSV guy. Clearly Craig's not, but wait a second. I'm gonna have a post where I announce that Satoshi's thoughts through my own Twitter and pretend that like I am the new Satoshi. Like, just next level cope.
It really is. All right, guys, that wraps up Rekt, and we are gonna move it on over to the Hopium.
Up next, we have Hopium, sponsored by Proof of Ink. Proof of Ink are a Bitcoin apparel and accessories company, developing all sorts of cool collaborations. Here you see the Pleb Underground merch coming very, very soon to an address or PO box near you. Guys, if you head over to proofofink.com, you can get a 5.8% discount on all of their goodies if you use the code PLEB. Once again, that's 5.8% off all of the goodies over at proofofink.com. Thank you for supporting Proof of Ink and Pleb Underground. If you buy some of their merch, we will be very much appreciated. Thank you. Welcome back to Hopium, where this week I'm sharing a few stories with you. The first story, one that tricked even me for a brief period of time. Some gold miner apparently was going to buy 24,000 Bitcoin. What later happened is actually this gold miner was very small, and it was some sort of pump and dump scheme. But yeah, as always, kind of proves our point of Hopium. Watch out for Hopium. Watch out for hopeful stories, because they may not be as they seem. Gentlemen, did you catch this? I'm sure you saw it midweek.
Not only did I catch it, but I dug into it, and it is one of the weirdest stories. We actually have two clips on it, but essentially, right? What happened? So the CEO, the COO, okay, which was hired on about 2 years ago, is like a blockchain marketing person. Okay, so that's already weird. And then if you go to their website, so on her LinkedIn, it links to a completely different website of a holding company. But then if you go to their website, it links to a South American mining company that looks like something, you know, that like a child put together as like a school project. It's, and the other, the, like for me, the other red flag, especially knowing what I know about pink sheet stocks and these exploration stage miners, all they list is the land that they own and the amount of gold that, or and silver that could be mined. It's like, please. It's just bullshit.
Yeah, no, I saw that come through. It was actually one of my favorite Bitcoiners that had initially retweeted. His name's Turtemeester, and he's a longtime kind of Bitcoiner who views things from the financial aspect of Bitcoin. And he tweeted it, and it wasn't 5 or 10 minutes before he's always so responsible with his Twitter account. So he deleted the tweet and then put up a new tweet saying that he had deleted the tweet and why, and that it was basically a pump and dump or something
That's
by
right.
a penny stock that was looking to create, some market movement and profit from that.
And they did. Yeah. The CEO left, by the way. He resigned, and he
Yep.
actually called it a pump and dump himself. Sorry, Walton, go on.
That's right. So yeah, be wary of hopium. Quod erat demonstrandum. Thank you. All right. So next story. This one I think is very exciting. Tweet for myself here. Apparently the number one core
Yeah.
contributor, Vladimir van der Laan. And if you don't know, this guy's the only guy that has more than 10,000 commits to Bitcoin Core, I believe. Like he's number one by a long, long way. In total commits to Bitcoin Core, is apparently returning to do further development. I don't have more details on this story, but to me that sounds very, very bullish indeed, gentlemen. What do you think?
I like to think that's a natural consequence of what Craig Wright was doing was a form of patent trolling, and I would like to think that the legal clarity that has, been achieved as a result of his defeat in court may loosen things up. For I know he's not the only core developer that felt pressured or felt anxiety due to some of these litigious court cases. What concerns me is, it's the same kind of thing we talked about with FUD around SeedCenter before. Like it takes an order of magnitude more energy to refute the attack than
That's
it
right.
does to launch it. So unfortunately, I don't think this is a silver bullet for all of the threats that might be directed towards core developers, but maybe it does establish some solid precedent to give them some legal cover if or when additional challenges arise.
Yeah, I definitely think that it is a bullish development, right? And I think to your point, Seed, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is a natural consequence of people, these patent trolls, specifically Craig Wright et al. That's it. Like they now shouldn't have a leg to stand on, and now these good core contributors, right, that felt threatened, well, they can take a second look at this, and maybe realize that they're going to be okay here. I also think it. I also think it kind of helps show the effectiveness of a consortium like COPPA as well. So yeah, it's good stuff.
Good. Well, I have one final story for you in Hopium this week, and that is that I'm hosting a party.
What?
The London Bitcoin Halving Party. It's going to be on 420. That's the April 20th in London, Dockside Vaults, from 6 p.m. till midnight. You can buy tickets using Bitcoin. We're going to have an educational workshops. We're going to have a Bitcoin art gallery. There's going to be a big party. We're going to have hundreds of Bitcoiners and their guests in attendance. That's the London Bitcoin Halving Party. So yeah, I am
Wow.
feeling hopeful because yeah, Bitcoin meetups, Bitcoin parties really can be rather entertaining. Especially when I'm organizing them. And yeah, maybe that's a humble brag. Maybe it's not. But I had a great party in Madeira. We had like 100 people like on the last night impromptu. So some people come up to me and like at a Bitcoin meeting, they say, what do you do for Bitcoin? And I say, what do you do in Bitcoin? And I say, I have fun. And I'm 100% serious on this. Like there's a lot of people building some really important things in Bitcoin. But it's important also that people in Bitcoin have fun. And so I try to do that, and I try to help other people do that as well. So yeah,
There is no
have fun in Bitcoin,
substitute.
guys.
There is no substitute for IRL interactions with other Bitcoiners to just commiserate and celebrate and just talk about this revolution that we're so excited about. So you're giving me some FOMO. I wish I could just hop on the Concorde and scoot across the pond to attend.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, that wraps up Wrecked, and it all, sorry, it wraps up Hopium, not Wrecked, it wraps up Hopium, and it also wraps up our episode for the week. Guys, don't forget, like, subscribe, help us grow the show. Seed, if you could give the audience one more time your contact details, how can they find you? How can they get in touch with you and learn more about Seed Signer?
For sure. Just at Seed Signer at Twitter, and you can find us on Nostra et al. That's the best place to start. And it's not as complex or as intimidating to buy the parts and build your own Seed Signer and learn more about Bitcoin cold storage in the process. So give it a look. But other than that, kill your heroes and yeah, keep Bitcoining.
Very nice. Very nice. And I can say I built my own Seed Signer. You guys have a great guide. Definitely check it out. Guys, don't forget to, again, like and subscribe. Help us out, all right? Don't forget to check us out on our audio-only platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. If you want to stream us sats, check us out on Fountain.fm. You can stream us sats through Breeze. Walton, how do we finish this? How do we end this?
Fuckshitcoins.com. Please like and subscribe. We will see you next week. More toxic than the most toxic Bitcoin maxi ever. Said he's more toxic, more toxic than the most.